to the Spirituality Podcast, brought to you by the Spiritual Life and Learning Center, a ministry of First Community Church in Columbus, Ohio. The Spiritual Life and Learning Center is a lifelong learning community helping people navigate their unique journey toward intentional, meaningful, and spiritual living. We welcome people from all religious and spiritual traditions and from no tradition who are seeking to deepen their relationship with themselves, others, and the divine. If you find this podcast helpful, please be sure to like it and share it with others. You can also check out our webpage at fcchurch.com and then click on Ministries. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Thank you, Seth. And thank you, Seth and Jen and the people at your community, for all of you for this opportunity. I'm really so happy to be with you. Really, what greater gift can an author get that people want to talk about his or her book? So I'm just happy about that. And the book deals with some very, very personal issues. And as you may have, I think I mentioned that in the introduction, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to see if this makes sense for my fellow Christians. If I was going in a direction in which could be helpful for Christians, or just going off on my own path in my explorations of Buddhism. So this is another opportunity, to see how it plays, in the Christian congregation. So I'm very, very grateful for that. So I kind of want to move rather quickly. And I prepared a little PowerPoint, a presentation that I think will kind of help us move along more clearly and coherently. So I'm going to try to get on to that right now. And I hope this works. Okay. Good. Is that on your screen now, God and Nirvana? Very good. Okay. That is our topic for today. And I wanted to start with some introductory remarks, kind of maybe as I have it here, where I'm coming from. So you have a little bit of background on me. You get some of that in the book itself, but just briefly, that yes, I grew up in the Roman Catholic tradition, back in Chicago, where I'm originally from. In a typical Catholic family, and I'm still hanging in there with the Catholic tradition, despite all the problems we have, and boy, do we have them. But if it wasn't clear, I was ordained a priest, a Catholic priest, back in 1966 in Rome, where I had finished my doctoral studies. What is called a licentiate, getting a master's degree in theology at the Gregorian Pontifical University in Rome. So I'm a product of the Second Vatican Council. I was one of the greatest blessings of my life, namely that I was sent to Rome, but I was sent to Rome. I arrived at the end of September in 1962, and Two weeks later, on October 11th, Pope John Paul XXIII led something, 1,400 bishops or so, into St. Peter's Basilica to start the Second Vatican Council. And that was kind of when the Catholic Church finally responded to Martin Luther's call for reform. They started to reform. And it was just an exciting time, well, to be a Catholic, but also to be in Rome. And it was especially one of the things that the Second Vatican Council really opened up was the attitude of the Catholic Church towards other religions. I mean, something they taught, something that was just unbelievable. It was the council, the Second Vatican Council, taught that God was present in other religions and that Catholics are called to dialogue with other religions. That was such an inspiration for me. And that that led me, you know, to have interreligious dialogue, how to engage with other religions as kind of the central topic of my life as a both as a Christian, but also as a professional theologian. Well, I finished my doctoral studies in Germany in 1972, came back and taught at a seminary in Chicago for a couple of years. But it was in 1975 that I realized that the priesthood was not for me. We can get into why and such. I requested at that time a permission from the Catholic Church, from Rome, the Vatican, to leave the priesthood and to get married. And I got it and was married then in 19, can't forget my wedding anniversary, you better not. In 1982, actually on New Year's Eve of 1982. And I'm my wife, Kathy Cornell, and I have two children grown now. And I've just recently become, for the third time, on March 12th, a grandpa for the third time. So, but my work has been primarily as a, what I call an interreligious theologian. And as Seth referred to it, I taught at Xavier for almost 30 years, took an early retirement in 2002 from Xavier, was happily retired, but then got an invitation to take a position at Union Theological Seminary, that you may know, a Protestant seminary in New York City. And I was there from 2007 to 2013 when I retired for the second time. And then my wife and I moved here to Madison, Wisconsin. So what I want to do is in the book, as you saw, I'm talking about my difficulties as a Christian believer, difficulties that I've struggled with. And I certainly don't want to say that my problems have to be your problems. But I suspect that a lot of us Christians are struggling with some of the issues that I have struggled with. I mean, things like, just the whole notion of God as this heavenly being up in heaven who controls everything, that this God, you know, sent his son as the only savior of the world, and Jesus saves us by dying on the cross to satisfy God's anger. Things like Christianity as traditionally taught, it's just the superior religion over all other religions. These are just things I've struggled with. And over the years, I have found that Buddhism has been a help in this, in my theological work, in trying to figure out what do I really believe as a Christian. And so in the book, I try to lay out just how Buddhism has been a help for me. But again, I don't want to say that everybody needs Buddhism in order to deal with their Christian problems, not at all. But I do think Buddhism can offer us Christians some significant help. And that's what I would like to talk about with you today. And it's the way I do it in the book, as you've seen, it was a process of laying out my problems and then passing over, that's a kind of some jargon from theologians, passing over to another tradition, trying to really enter into it, not just, you know, with your head, but also with your heart and feelings, and then pass back to your own original religion to see what kind of light your experience in the other religion might shed on your own religion. So that's been really that kind of passing back and forth and dialogue with Buddhism has been a major part of my life. I have become what what, again, to use some jargon from theologians, but I've become something that I think a growing number of Christians are becoming, namely, I'm a double belonger. Spiritual double belonging is a growing phenomenon. People, in other words, who draw their spiritual nourishment not just from one religion, but from two or maybe three, or whatever. But they find that one religious tradition, although it may be their primary identity, is not sufficient. And they find help then from other religions. And that's been then the story of my struggles since, well, I think since going back to the mid or to late 80s, when I really started to study and then to practice Buddhism. So first, I want to say a few words about my struggles with God as a transcendent and personal other. And what I mean by a transcendent, totally other, this is, you know, I think what I'm talking about here is this notion of God. Marcus Borg, whom some of you may know from your readings, Marcus Borg talks about this God as the God of supernatural theism. And this is the God that has his male, has his existence outside of the world and is fully complete and fulfilled in himself. Really a God who doesn't need anything because God is perfect in himself, but this God decides to create and bring forth creation. And then the creation gets into difficulty and God has to rescue creation by sending his son. But it's this God of a really what I think it's a question of, the problem has to do with, again, it's a philosophical term, but I think it can help, of dualism. Dualism between God and creation. And what I mean by that is the way we Christians, and by the way, it's not just Christianity, but speaking about Christianity, the way we Christians have really made a distinction, of course, between God and creation, a very necessary distinction. But then I think we go ahead and we make too much of the distinction. We want to make sure that God stays God and doesn't get mixed up with humanity. Got to be aware of pantheism. And so it becomes two distinct beings. We have so insisted on the infinite distance between God and the world that we Christians end up with God and creatures not on two ends of the same playing field, but kind of in two different stadiums. This is a God out there, a God who has to come down. And I think that has been especially one of my primary problems. Okay, whether it's yours or not, we can talk about it. But continuing though, the problem also with God as a person, and is almighty. The personal problem is, I read somewhere long ago that Carl Gustav Jung said that God as a person becomes a problem, especially after they enter their 40s. Now, I don't know what that, as we kind of deep, our maturity even deepens. But more and more people then at that age, which is not to say not before that age, of course, have difficulty with this notion of God as a being, as an entity. And that reminds me of something a Jesuit, a German Jesuit who spent his life in Japan and dialoguing with Buddhists, but he once wrote and he said, a precondition for Christians to address God as you should be the realization that we shouldn't do that, that we should not call God a you. Then you have permission to do so. In other words, this awareness that God is, of course, is more than a you, and that when we talk about God as a you, we're using an anthropomorphism. We're using some of our notions of ourselves, of humanity, and applying them to God. And you know, theologians may tell us now we have to be careful about anthropomorphisms. You know, what I'm talking about is God as a being who gets angry, or God as a being who talks from a cloud, or God as a being who can kill all the firstborn of Egypt because they offended his people. I mean, these are anthropomorphisms that you just can't say, well, they're symbol. These just get stuck in my own spiritual experience of what do we mean when we use these kind of anthropomorphisms. And then when we talk about this person, God, as almighty, it seems that the divine thou has become like a super thou, a super being who, as I said, is in charge of everything and who has a predetermined will, God's will, that we have to follow. And again, it just doesn't feel right. It doesn't nurture my faith. And then especially, now here I may be too much think too much or a philosopher, but how to explain this God whom we say is a loving father in a world that is just so messed up, in which there's just so much suffering. We say, you've heard this, I think, we say that God is all loving and all powerful, right? I mean, that's basic Christian, all loving, all powerful. Well, if he's all loving, then he should want to do something about the incredible sufferings that human beings go through, especially, you know, in wars or in also the sicknesses. He would want, any loving father or parent would want to do something about it. And he's all powerful. In other words, he can do something about it, but he doesn't. Something's wrong here. I mean, and it's the traditional problem of evil, I know, but it's still, it's a problem that has been a problem for me and irked me for a long time. So now that was stating my difficulties. Now I want to talk about what I've learned from Buddhism, and this is a drastic summary, my passing over to Buddhism, especially under this notion of Nirvana. Well, one of the first things you could say about Buddhism, and you probably saw that if you followed that series, that Buddhists don't talk about God. That's why some people have called Buddhism an atheistic religion, which is not true. They not to want to talk about God doesn't mean that they necessarily explicitly deny it. But Buddhists they're not concerned with God. What they're after primarily is experience, the experience of what they call enlightenment, which leads then to an experience of nirvana, which, again, that's a term that they use. And so that's their main intent. And in a sense, God gets in the way of that for them. And in other words, they don't want to spend their time figuring out, is there a God? Who is this God? How does this God act? They just, again, as I said, primarily want to have the experience, at least to begin to have the experience of enlightenment. I think I mentioned in the book somewhere the famous parable of the man shot with a poison arrow that Buddha has used when it comes to why Buddhists don't want to talk about God. It was this guy who was shot with a poison arrow, and he's lying on the road with the arrow sticking in him and poison, and his friends come up to him to try to help him. And he's saying, who shot this arrow? You know, what kind of poison is it? You know, why did he do it? And his friends say, shut up. I mean, we got to get this damn arrow out of you. You know, stop all your questions and let's just deal with this problem of suffering due to this arrow. That's kind of a way of why they prefer not to speak about God. Well, okay. You say, all right, what their primary interest is enlightenment, what is enlightenment? What is nirvana? And here, I want to proceed very cautiously, because there's all kinds of ways you can answer that question, but I'm working with especially certain Buddhists, for those of you who know more about Buddhism, from the Mahayana tradition, and some contemporary Buddhists who have been a big help for me in understanding Buddhism. And I think one way of describing enlightenment or nirvana is to say, and this is especially from Thich Nhat Hanh, nirvana, enlightenment, is the experience of the interbeing, the interconnectedness of everything. It's an experience that is beyond words. It can't be described, but it's this sense of how everything is intertwined and interconnected, including me. My being is part of that. And so Buddhists describe the experience of enlightenment as anatta. That's the Pali word. It's there, A-N-A-T-T-A. It means no self. That you start to experience yourself as losing yourself, your identity, your personal being, your being as little Paul Knitter, or as Seth, and you find yourself to be part of and to be primarily part of this interconnectedness of what Thich Nhat Hanh and other Buddhists call interbeing. So it's an awareness that no person, no human being exists by themselves. They exist in relationship with others. And that includes also of everything else that exists, whether animals or material reality, and of course, contemporary physics is bearing this out. You know, everything is interconnected. It's not just that no man is an island, as was it John Donne, the poet, said. No, nothing is an island. Nothing can exist by itself. We are all non-selves, non-individual selves. So this experience, then, the Buddhists claim, is available to us right now, right here. So nirvana is nowhere. You can't say it's... But that means it's now here. It's a play on words that you can do only in English and is a little bit cute, but it really gets to the, it's right now, right here. This interconnectedness is available. And if you can get in touch with it, it can start to transform your life. So continuing our passing over to Buddhism, further, to experience the interbeing of everything, Buddhists say, is also to feel compassion and care for everything. Why? Because you're connected with everything. Everything, in a sense, is also you. So the Buddhists would say Jesus was right on when he said, love your neighbor as yourself, because your neighbor, in a certain sense, is yourself, is vital for you. And just as you love yourself, you're going to start loving your neighbor. So this is why, again, those of you who have been able to study a little bit of Buddhism, these are the two faces of enlightenment. What the Buddhists say, wisdom and compassion. Wisdom means growing into this sense of being part of this interconnected reality. That's wisdom, that's waking up to that. And as soon as you start to wake up to that, you will automatically, not because it's a commandment, but you will automatically start to feel a compassion for others. So this interbeing, it's not a person. It's not an entity. But it is something that oozes with compassion. That when you start to sense it or to feel it, you're going to be carried by compassion. Even though there's no personal God telling you that you're supposed to love your neighbor, you will be compassion. So what does this mean then for the question of evil? And here, I think you could say, this is the way I'm putting it. I hope it's helpful. I hope it's accurate. But for Buddhists, evil isn't really what it looks like. In a sense, Buddhists don't talk about evil. They talk about suffering. Suffering. Suffering is the problem. They don't want to call that suffering evil. But they recognize suffering as something that we have to deal with. But they don't want to call anything evil because they feel that's only going to make things worse. Because as soon as you say something is evil, you gotta get rid of it. You gotta destroy it. You're going to find out you're going to hate it. And as soon as you start hating what you have to deal with, Buddhists feel you're only going to add to the problem of our situation. So for them, evil, suffering, results not from the devil. They speak a lot about, you know, demonic kind of imagery. That's a whole other question. But they have no notion of the devil as we do. Nor do they have a notion as we Christians, especially, I think, Protestant Christians, of ourselves as fallen, as having a sinful nature. The cause of suffering for Buddhism is from ignorance. It's because we don't know who we really are. And because we don't know that, we get uptight, we get afraid, we get greedy, we got to hold on to things, we got to be in absolute control. And that's what causes, as a Buddhist, the three poisons. Ignorance is the first poison, leads to greed, and it leads to hatred. Ignorance, greed, hatred. The greed and the hatred coming from ignorance are what they call avidya. So now this is something we can get into more. For the Buddhists, when evil happens, when we end up suffering, especially because of what somebody does to us, or suffering because we've come down with COVID, or God forbid, cancer. This is what happens. We have to first accept it and not try to run away from it, reject it. It's there, and then and this needs a lot more explanation, I know. We, knowing that because we are interconnected, we will be able to deal with it. We will be able to deal with it. I think we're going to have an opportunity to talk about that in coming sessions, especially when we get into working for peace in the last session. So, passing back, how can I apply this, or how does this help me understand my own Christian belief in God? Well, the first thing that Buddhists want to remind Christians of, or I think they would want to, is that all of our talk about God is symbolic. We don't have any photographs, as it were, of God. All we can do is use symbols and metaphors. As you've heard this image that the Buddhists use all the time, all of our talk about God is fingers pointing to the moon being the reality of God, of ultimate reality. All of our talk are just fingers. Don't ever think your finger is the moon. That's the way symbols can be as dangerous as they are necessary, because that means we're going to make of our symbols, when we identify the symbol with God, the finger with the moon, we make an idol out of our language or out of our pointing fingers. So this is not from Buddhism, but it's from some Christian theologians, I think, that fits what Buddhism wants to tell Christians. We have to take our symbols of God as creator, our symbols of Jesus as the Son of God, our symbols of the Trinity, God as Father, Son, and Spirit. We've got to take them seriously, but not literally. And maybe we want to talk more about that, but that is something, for me, when I realized that, that was such a freeing for me. That I don't have to take these symbols literally, but then I was free to take them seriously. Moving along then. So I think, now here I want to be very careful, but I think that trying to understand the mystery of God in the light of what Buddhism has taught me, I venture to say that we could talk about God as a connecting spirit. As you saw in the book, that's a symbol that I think can really work. But for this symbol to work, Buddhism is calling us to become mystics. In other words, we're back to the stress on experience. Buddhists don't want to talk about God. They want to have the experience of enlightenment. Applying that to Christianity, I think we can say that for us Christians, Buddhists are reminding us that God needs to be an experience before God can be a word that we understand. Unless God is an experience, whatever words we might use for the divine will be, I think, without content. Road signs pointing nowhere, or maybe like light bulbs without electricity. This fits in very much with what I learned from one of my teachers when I was studying in Germany back in the end of the 60s, early 70s, a Catholic theologian that is known by Karl Rahner was my teacher, and Karl, a Jesuit priest, long dead, who said that the future Christian will have to be a mystic, or he or she will not be able to endure as a Christian. Without some kind of mystical experience, Christians are not going to be able to carry on. And so I think that's what, and we'll be talking about that in one of our sessions. What does this mean in the session on prayer and meditation? But moving on then, so what I'm suggesting is that, again, we can talk about maybe a symbol for God, a way of talking about God, to understand God as interbeing, as the interconnectedness of everything, that which connects. So it's really, really, I think, very consistent with what Christians have said about who God is. If you read the New Testament carefully, there's only two instances, I think, where you have a sentence like God is. And the one is from the first letter of John, where it says, God is love. What is love but an interconnecting energy? The interconnection that we feel with others, or that we receive from others. This would be God as an interconnecting spirit. And in fact, the other definition, if you want to use that word, for God that we find in the New Testament is God is spirit, also from John's gospel. God is, and what is spirit? But this spirit can't be seen, but it's present as an energy within us. It's animating us. And so I think this, with Buddhism, these symbols, this language can take on life. And then especially as the Trinity, we can't get into that, but the whole Christian notion of a Trinity means you can't talk about God as one being. God is more than one because God is relationship. You got to have relationships within the very being of God. And so Christians talk about God as parent, God as son, God as spirit, the love. So, and it's the Christian way of getting at God as essentially a interconnecting energy. And so that's what I'm suggesting, that the Christian symbol for God might well be spirit, an interconnecting spirit. But continuing, and I see that I want to wrap things up here soon, but passing back to, again, exploring God as a connecting spirit, God then becomes not a person, but God is a, now see, this is where language is, so we just don't find neat language. But God is as I have it here, not a person, but a connecting energy. It's this energy alive. It's up to something. It calls us. It enables us to feel connected. It enables us to feel love and to express love. And the more. We can wake up to this interconnecting spirit, this interconnecting energy, this animating presence, the more we're going to find ourselves able to feel at peace, to know that no matter what happens, this, again, using this language, this interconnecting spirit is what we are. It's what gives us existence. And so we're held in it. We're sustained in it. And then it connects us with other beings, especially human beings, with compassion. So it's a spirit that grounds us in peace personally and connects us in compassion with others socially. So our life then might be another image, another symbol we can think of and feel, not just think of, but feel our lives as, it's a symbol, as a dance with the spirit. A lot of religions, Hinduism especially, talks about human existence as lila, as a dance with God, with the spirit, a dance in which we're partners with God, but it's like a dancing couple. God is kind of the lead, takes the lead, but the dance can happen only when we are responding to God's lead. And so we need God for the lead, but God needs us for the dance. God can't dance by God's self. So this means, this is an affirmation of something we read in the New Testament and the Acts of the Apostles, where it is God, God is that in which we live and move and have our being. What is it? I'm a Catholic, so I don't know my Bible very well. What I think it's, Seth, do you happen to know where that is in the Acts of the Apostles or anybody? Anyway, but it's there. God is that in which we live and move and have our being. That is really confirmed by Buddhism. But Buddhism would add, and we human beings are that in which God lives and moves and has God's being. There's a real mutuality, a non-dualism between God and the world, between God and ourselves. And just to conclude, I know I'm over time, this means that yes, suffering exists, but it never has the final word. No matter what happens, if we understand God as the spirit of interbeing, creatively interacting with the world, rather than as an almighty personal being in charge of the world, we can no longer blame evil on God. Evil will come either from people out of ignorance and using their free will and doing horrible things, or it will come out of the randomness of nature. When God created the world, from Buddhist perspective, the world functions as it does. And as we know from contemporary science and evolution, the evolution takes place through random changing, randomness. But no matter what human beings do, no matter what happens by chance, we are sustained by this ever-present interconnecting spirit that sustains us. And so I love this saying. This is a Christian, a Catholic spiritual teacher, Jim Findlay. He says, ours, talking to Christian, ours is a God who protects us from nothing, but sustains us in everything. A God who's not going to zap us or intervene and work a miracle, because stuff happens, but that God will be present, sustaining us no matter what. And just a final word, and we can talk more about this. This understanding of God as a interconnecting spirit and evil as coming out of ignorance, I think it enables me as a theologian to understand our human predicament not as an original sin, but as some kind of original ignorance, which makes a big difference, I think, Because if it's sin and we're fallen, that stays. We remain, at least according to some Christian theology, we stay fallen. But if we understand our problem as original ignorance, the possibilities of doing something about it are so much greater. So I think I'll leave it at that. And I suspect I'm going to stop share screen so that we can see each other. I really would, and please, it's not just a question and answer, but conversation. If you want to say something, some ideas you have, want to suggest that are contributing, please, let's just do it that way. So let's just have a conversation, you know, as honestly and clearly as we can.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Spirituality Podcast, brought to you by the Spiritual Life and Learning Center, a ministry of First Community Church in Columbus, Ohio. If you found this podcast helpful, please be sure to like it and then share it with others. You can also check out our webpage at fcchurch.com and click on Ministries. Again, thank you for listening.